of the Grammy Award-winning band Calle 13, Il Residente and Bad Bunny co-wrote and recorded the new song Sharpening the Knives, the anthem for the Puerto Rican resistance demanding Governor Rossio resign. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Literary Arts, presenting author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates in celebration of his new book, The Water Dancer, Monday, October 21st at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in conversation with author Renee Watson. Tickets and more information at literaryarts.org. It's 5 o'clock. Time for the KBOO Evening News.
Tune into KBOO Wednesday, July 24th from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. for the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon. Broadcasting from a different city each year and airing on non-commercial radio stations coast to coast, this annual marathon features live reports, interviews with advocates and experts, and calls from listeners all over the country. This year's programming includes the voices of youth, students, and LGBTQ people, panels on fighting evictions, transitioning people back into housing, and ending homelessness now. That's the Homelessness Marathon, Wednesday, July 24th, from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Ever wonder what happens to your Fred Meyer reward points? Now you can turn them into excellent community radio by linking your Fred Meyer rewards card to KBOO. Look up KBOO or our ID number 86634 at fredmeyer.com/community rewards. Every time you use your card, KBOO will get money. Your rebates, discounts, and gas bonuses are unaffected. With your Fred Meyer reward card, you can even turn cat litter into support for KBOO. Go to fredmeyer.com/community rewards, all one word, and link your card to KBOO.
Meow.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon passes a historic reform law for juvenile offenders.
The Trump administration is proposing a rule that would remove more than 3 million people from the food stamp program.
And in international news, government data shows hate crimes in Canada have decreased for the first time in 5 years.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019. I'm Lisa Loving.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Governor Kate Brown signed into law Monday a package of policy changes that will have a sweeping effect on the juvenile justice system in the state. The new law will stop youths that are accused of serious crimes being funneled straight into the adult court system. Instead, prosecutors wishing to bring Measure 11 charges against juvenile offenders will have to first request a formal hearing, which will determine if the case will go to adult court. Juveniles are also now eligible for a parole hearing after serving half of their sentence. Lawmakers have tried to push through sentencing reform since 2013. After signing the bill, Brown said, quote, "By changing the sentencing guidelines for youth offenders, our communities will be safer and more Oregonians will have better chances of using their time in custody to make a turnaround in their lives." It goes into effect January 1st, 2020.
Starting July 31st, survivors of sexual assault in Oregon will be able to track the status of police investigations. The Sexual Assault Management System Victim Portal was created after the Oregon House Bill 4049 was passed last year. The bill forces law enforcement to give survivors an anonymous way to track their sexual assault forensic evidence kit. The tracker will also allow for real-time updates on the status of the investigation and does not require login information for privacy reasons.
Hospitals and health insurance companies in the Mile High State are cashing in on poor people's medical care. A new report shows that commercial insurance plans pay Colorado hospitals, on average, almost three times what Medicare pays for that same care. Eric Galitis reports from the Public News Service.
A hospital in Fort Morgan charges nearly 8 times more than Medicare reimbursements. That's according to a new hospital value report on pricing and performance. Bob Smith with the Colorado Business Group on Health, one of the groups behind the report, says current incentives in place have boosted stock values, but the marketplace is not working for firefighters and school districts who have been hit with rising costs.
Colorado hospital net profit is 4 to 5 times the average hospital in the country. Insurers have seen their earnings per share go up anywhere from 300% to 1,000% in the last decade. The system works really well for them.
The report found that performance outcomes vary as much between as within hospitals, and Smith says there seems to be no reliable correlation between price and quality of care. Hospital administrators have long argued that higher costs are passed along to commercial plans to help make up for what they believe are insufficient Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements. Hospitals also charge more to cover the costs of treating people who can't afford to pay. I'm Eric Galatis. A hospital in Fort Morgan charges nearly 8 times more than Medicare reimbursements. That's according to
Over 100 coal miners with black lung disease took to Washington, D.C. today to urge Congress to restore a higher excise tax level on coal companies to help fund their medical care. Rates of progressive respiratory disease are on the rise across Appalachia and show no signs of slowing down anytime soon. Earlier this year, Congress neglected to take action to maintain the rate that coal companies have to pay to finance the Federal Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. As a result of declining to take action, the excise tax on underground coal production dropped from $1.10 to just 50 cents. The fund is intended to help disabled miners whose employers go bankrupt and can no longer pay out medical benefits. Since tax rates dropped, the fund has been forced to borrow more than $6 billion from the U.S. Treasury to finance medical benefits.
In New York State, a program that helps disabled people stay in their homes could be severely impacted by budget cuts. Andrea Sears reports from the Public News Service.
Pardon our technical difficulties, and now we continue with the KBOO Evening News.
Personal assistance program allows people who need home care to hire those who provide that help, including friends or family members. The program helps more than 70,000 New Yorkers get paid assistance from people they already know and trust instead of relying on agencies to send strangers into their homes. The state budget cuts the funding for the fiscal intermediaries who administer the program by $150 million. According to Heidi Siegfried with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York, that will effectively end availability of the program for many participants.
Fiscal intermediaries are saying they're just not going to be able to manage this, and having hundreds close their doors means there's going to be no other fiscal intermediary that the worker and the consumer can turn to continue to provide the service.
The state's budget office says the cut will not reduce the number of people enrolled in the program or the hours of care they receive.
Was Andrea Sears reporting from New York.
The Trump administration is proposing a rule that would remove more than 3 million people from the food stamp program. No, U.S. I'm looking for the wildlife story. No, it's food stamps. Okay, good. Sorry, this is live radio if you're listening right now. This is the KBOO Evening News. The Trump administration is proposing a rule that would remove more than 3 million people from the food stamp program. This would take away enrollment for food stamps from low-income families who receive welfare. 43 states allow families to qualify for federal assistance. Ending this program would cut the spending by $2.5 billion a year and would save billions in taxpayer funds. People who lose their benefits can reapply and qualify for assistance. Trump administration said the proposal would, quote, fix a loophole for families that receive assistance when they don't need it. This proposal also affects free lunches for students. Children would have to apply separately to receive free meals. This could increase the food insecurity for low-income families.
Congress is considering a bill that would direct nearly $1.4 billion to wildlife agencies. Trimble Gomes reports from the Public News Service.
Introduced in the House by Michigan Democrat Debbie Dingell and Nebraska Republican Jeff Fortenberry, the Recovery America's Wildlife Act aims to help states protect an estimated 12,000 at-risk species of fish and wildlife across the country. Preston Robertson with the Florida Wildlife Federation says Florida is unique with its semi-tropical climate growing plants, animals, and insects that exist only here but are being squeezed out by rapid development.
And all of our water quality issues, blue-green algae, and red tide, we need to do something to make sure that it's over 1,000 species that have been listed by the state that are in danger of becoming extirpated from the state.
The funding would help Florida implement its action plan designed to monitor species health and pinpoint which ones and their habitats need to be conserved before they become rare and costly to protect. The bill has 75 co-sponsors, including Representatives Charlie Crist, Matt Gaetz, and four other Florida lawmakers. It now needs a vote by the House Natural Resources and Budget Subcommittees.
Now it's time for the Green News Report, 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, and analysis with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen.
It's Thursday, July 18, 2019.
32 states will see heat indexes above 100. 200 million people will be feeling the heat and the humidity.
Yet another dangerous heat wave broils the U.S.
Broiled U.S. Sounds delicious.
Are we now in a pattern of continually breaking these climate records?
Yeah, I hate to say that we told you so, but we told you so.
America to see off-the-charts heat in coming decades. Plus, Trump administration moves to protect polluting industries from the tyranny of local control.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Trump administration may go down as one of the truly great environmental administrations. Nobody will believe that.
Because it's a lie. Hey, who knew? Senator James Inhofe is still alive. Go figure. This is your Green News Report. I'm gonna soak up the sun. Okay, Desi Doyen, I got to play Michael Mann's clip again here because...
I hate to say that we told you so, but we told you so. We predicted this decades ago.
Yep, he did, they did, and I wonder how many people will be listening to him now that they will be broiling for the next several days.
Yep, as we go to air, cities around the nation are implementing emergency measures to deal with yet another dangerous, potentially record-setting heat wave across most of the U.S.
Who could have predicted it?
We told you so.
Now, of course, there is no analysis yet of this heat wave's relationship to climate change, but it does fit the pattern of global warming making heat waves increasingly more frequent, longer, and more intense. So keep that in mind for this next story. If we do little or nothing to cut our greenhouse gas emissions, most of the United States will see twice as many extreme heat days within the next 20 or 30 years, underscoring that climate change is a growing public health threat. According to a new study released this week, the number of days when the heat index, that's the feels-like combination of heat and humidity, when the heat index soars above 100 degrees Fahrenheit or higher, will double within the next 20 years. And heat waves will go from lasting days to lasting weeks. Some U.S. cities will even see off-the-charts heat days of as much as 127 degrees, which is beyond the current heat index. According to climate scientist Michael Mann in an interview with Euronews, that's what we'll see if we don't move quickly to phase out fossil fuels.
What, you know, we think of as, you know, unprecedented extreme record heat today, the latest studies show that if we continue on this path, we continue to burn fossil fuels, for decades to come, then the hottest day we've ever experienced will be a typical summer day in the future.
Well, I hate to say it, but he did tell us so.
He did. Now, that study also includes a tool to look up your location, along with direct actions that every community can take to cut their emissions and get ready for hotter temperatures. We'll have that link at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
And you're going to have to do something with all that time you're going to be spending indoors in the air condition because you can't even go outside.
Extreme heat, of course, brings other consequences. A different new study this week finds that the amount of land burned by wildfires in the United States has doubled over the last 30 years because of hotter temperatures. It's even worse in California. Wildfires there burn five times more land today than they did in the 1970s, thanks to global warming.
Even though we've cleaned up the forests and swept the floor and done all that stuff that Donald Trump told us to do?
Yeah.
Wow.
According to the lead author, quote, each degree of warming causes way more fire than the previous degree of warming did.
We got to do more sweeping.
In other news, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency plans to introduce a major policy change to curtail the ability of local communities to appeal pollution permits granted to industries in their area. The EPA's move weakens rules that for decades have given locals a voice in determining how much pollution industrial facilities are legally allowed to release into their neighborhoods. But polluters, however, will still be allowed to continue using that appeals process to obtain permission to pollute more.
So the people on the ground in the small towns, the local governments, they will have less say about all of this?
Exactly.
So I beg of you, I plead, next time Democrats are in charge and you hear Republicans talking about how small government is better, how the people on the ground know best, please keep in mind they don't actually mean it.
And the U.S. Forest Service has also unveiled a plan to bypass a major environmental law that had required extensive environmental review before starting any new logging, road building, or mining projects in the public's forests. The new policy change includes a loophole that allows logging companies to clear-cut up to 7 miles of the public's forests with no environmental review or even public notice, meaning residents won't even know it's happening until the logging trucks show up.
You know, if you just cut down all the forests, you cut down on forest fires. Just saying. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Hey, it's hot outside. You're going to have to stay inside and do something. Find us, follow us, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report.
We told you so.
I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Hot town, summer in the city. Back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Been down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk.
On Tuesday, a new policy will give immigration officials the authority to deport more people without an immigration hearing. It would also remove the requirement that applied to undocumented immigrants arrested within 100 miles of the border. Immigrants who've been in the U.S. for less than 2 years could face expedited removal. The Department of Homeland Security said it would enhance the national security and reduce government costs. With this law, immigration officers would determine who could be deported quickly. 10.5 million undocumented immigrants are affected by this policy.
18-year-old Francisco Irwin Galicia is a U.S. citizen and was born in Dallas, Texas. Despite this, Galicia has been held in the custody of U.S. Customs and Border Protection and ICE for nearly 3 weeks. Galicia isn't the only one. Since 2012, ICE has mistakenly arrested 1,488 U.S. citizens with the intention of deportation. Many believe that the true number is much higher. In fact, approximately one-fifth of all citizenship claims of those in ICE custody have been proven to be accurate upon investigation. These investigations have taken months for some to be released and others years. For Francisco Irwin Galicia, his family members fear that despite providing legal documents proving his citizenship status, Galicia will be deported to a country where he's not a citizen. This is thanks to the Trump administration's newest immigration attack, an expedited removal policy. This policy would immediately deport any person who cannot prove that they are a U.S. citizen or have lived in the U.S. for more than 2 years without being seen before a judge. Galicia is being held in ICE's South Texas detention facility.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6 p.m., it's preference. Then at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather is going to be cool and cloudy with a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow's weather is looking to be partly cloudy with a high of 82 degrees. Today in history, in 1996, the U.S. women's gymnastics team won the Olympic gold medal for the very first time. This happened twice more in 2012 and 2016. The quote of the day is from one of the anchors of the 2016 Olympic gymnastics teams, Simone Biles, who owns more world championship gold medals than any female gymnast in history. She said, "I'd rather regret the risks that didn't work out than the chances I didn't take at all."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Indian Health Service has failed to meet its own standards for prescribing opioids. That's the takeaway from a recent federal audit by the Inspector General of the U.S. House and Human Services Department. Olivia Reingold gets some perspective on the issue from a Montana tribal leader.
The report urges IHS to adopt 12 recommendations, including tracking all opioid prescriptions patients filled, even at outside pharmacies, and analyzing prescribing data to minimize dosages that exceed federal guidelines. Charlie Headress is the vice chairman for the Assiniboine and Sioux tribes. He says IHS clinics on the Fort Peck Reservation already follow agency requirements to use safeguards like informed consent contracts and drug monitoring databases. But he says drugs, including opioids, are still a problem.
I mean, people are walking around like zombies. I'm not going to sugarcoat it.
For 30 years, he worked as an administrator for the Indian Health Service, where he says opioid prescribing got out of hand starting in the 80s. But now...
They have, put the skids on a lot of the abuse.
None of Montana's 13 IHS facilities were referenced in the Inspector General's report. Anecdotally, Headress says IHS's facilities near him have prescribed opioids more responsibly in recent years, but he's not sure it's cut down opioid abuse.
I don't think so, honestly, because they can get it elsewhere a lot easier than they can get it from their own clinics.
The Indian Health Service did not respond to requests for comment. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers want to repeal several laws which discriminate against Native Americans. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports many of the laws were passed more than a century ago.
Nearly half of the 11 laws that would be repealed by the Respect Act allow the federal government to withhold services, funds, and nullify treaties with tribes deemed, quote, hostile to the U.S. One law legalizes compulsory manual labor for Native American men. Another lets the U.S. government forcibly relocate tribal children to off-reservation boarding schools run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Most of the laws haven't been enforced in decades, but some in Congress call them racist and say repealing them would eliminate painful reminders of past mistreatment of Native Americans by the federal government. Arizona Democrat Tom O'Halloran is the sponsor of the House version of the bill.
They're archaic, but they're also disrespectful. They were laws written up a long time ago when this was a different nation. We're trying to take laws that could be enforced in the future and get them off the books.
Stories have increasingly emerged in recent years of widespread physical, sexual, and psychological abuse in BIA boarding schools. In the 19th century, the federal government began sending many Native American children to such facilities to assimilate them into mainstream white culture. It wasn't until Congress passed the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978 that parents were given the legal right to prevent their children from attending. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
A federal judge is expected to hear arguments from tribes and conservation groups Tuesday seeking an injunction to stop mining activity in the Santa Rita Mountains in Arizona. They want to halt work on a proposed copper mine to protect burial and other sacred sites. The Tohono O'odham, Pascua Yaqui, and Hopi tribes, along with Earth Justice, filed the request in May. Canadian mining company Hudbay Minerals plans to build the mine in southern Arizona. Acclaimed Native writer N. Scott Momaday is being honored by the Dayton Literary Peace Prize for his work to foster peace, social justice, and global understanding. Organizers of the prize announced Monday. The Kiowa novelist and poet will be honored in November in Dayton, Ohio. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In an overwhelming majority, the Senate passed a bill making the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund permanent. The House passed the bill on July 12th. Prior to the passing of the bill, the Victims Compensation Fund for anyone who suffered physical harm or was killed as a result of the terrorist-related attacks or the subsequent debris removal efforts that took place immediately after the crashes was set to run out of money in December of 2020. In June, comedian and longtime advocate for 9/11 first responders John Stewart delivered a heartbreaking testimony before Congress, slamming lawmakers for their lack of attention to the issue. Stewart delivered an emotional address today after the bill's passing.
This has been the honor of my life to work with the men and women behind me. Today it's about the heart of James Adroga and Joe, and the integrity of Ray Pfeiffer, and the courage of Lou Alvarez, and the tenacity of John Feel. They lifted this 9/11 community on their shoulders, and they carried them home. And I will always be so proud to have been associated with it. And we can never repay all that the 9/11 community has done for our country, but we can stop penalizing them. And today is that day that they can exhale, because unfortunately the pain and suffering of what these heroes continue to go through is going to continue. There have been too many funerals, too many hospices. These families deserve better, and I'm hopeful that today begins the process of being able to heal without the burden of having to advocate. And I will follow you whatever your next adventure shall be.
And that was John Stewart speaking in front of Congress today.
Robert Mueller is scheduled to testify tomorrow before both the House Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, beginning at 8:30 a.m. East Coast time. At stake is the question, what, if any, evidence does the Mueller report contain that points to high crimes and misdemeanors that may have been committed by Donald Trump during his 2016 campaign for president? Trump has stated that the report has totally exonerated him from any charges of obstruction or collusion. However, Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee plan to point to at least five instances where there is evidence of obstruction of justice. Mueller is expected to testify before the Judiciary from 8:30 until 10:30 a.m. and the Intelligence Committee from noon until 2 p.m. Mueller has already stated that he will not provide any information beyond what has already been made public in the redacted report.
And government data shows hate crimes in Canada have decreased for the first time in 5 years. 43% of crimes were targeting race and ethnicity, while 36% were targeting religion. The decrease was due to a decline in crimes against Muslims. There was a rise in hate crimes against Muslims, but it declined by 50% in 2018. However, the decline for crimes against Jews was 4% in 2018. Advocates share how the numbers don't tell the whole story because many hate crimes aren't reported to the police. While the hate crime rates are decreasing, Canada still has a long way to go.
You have been listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019. This has been a volunteer-produced newscast, and as always, we encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-503-503. 231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Al Khan, Imani Moore, Kenzie Beard, Alex Connor, Jeffrey Wade, and Chloe Noel, the newscat. The producer is Lisa Loving, and our engineer, Liam Delta. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Lisa Loving.
The St. Francis Church congregation spent last night protesting.
Actually, KBOO's Mackenzie Beard spoke with co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America's Portland chapter, Olivia Catby-Smith, and Emery Mort of Portland Resistance, about a rally they helped to organize against a war with Iran and Venezuela set for this Sunday in Portland.
This is Emery. We're here today because there is an anti-war rally coming up on Sunday that we've helped organize. There are something like 35 groups that are co-sponsoring it, and we want lots of people to come out, hear the speakers, go on a march, because we think it's really important that we show that we don't want war in Iran, we don't want war in Venezuela, and we think the sanctions that are hurting those people are really terrible.
Yeah, so the U.S. has a long and bloody track record of attempting to overthrow democratically elected governments all over the world. So we're mobilizing to stand in solidarity with the people of Iran and Venezuela to say no to war, but also to call for an end to economic violence of sanctions that are hurting the everyday people of these countries. You know, it's preventing them from accessing the things they need, like food and life-saving medicine. And we're also, of course, saying no to military action, no to a coup, and an end to media lies. You know, all too often the mainstream media seems like they are more than willing to do the U.S. government's warmongering for them. And it's activists like us and independent media platforms like this. You know, it's our responsibility to tell the truth to the world about what is really happening. And the truth is that enough innocent blood has been spilled at the hands of the United States government.
So then can you talk a little bit about what is really happening? What has led to tensions rising in Iran and also the sanctions that have been put on these people?
Yeah, so the United States is putting sanctions on both Iran and Venezuela. These have been pushed by National Security Advisor John Bolton. He's been urging an attack on Iran for years. And it was Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who's the Secretary of State, who pushed hardest for the crippling sanctions on Iran. And as a result of the sanctions, it's leading to shortages of imported goods and medicine that people need. It's directly hurting the civilians. And so we need to call for an end to these sanctions. And we also need to stand in solidarity with civil society in Iran. There are a lot of activists on the ground doing work against this in Iran and in Venezuela. And we need to stand in solidarity with them, as well as push back against our own government.
Yeah. And to add to that, most people know about the Iran deal, or the JCPOA, and even people on the left who are very critical of much of what President Obama did said that signing the JCPOA was one of the best things he did. And of course, Trump campaigned on getting out of the JCPOA, and which he did. And that agreement basically said that, hey, Iran, if you don't enrich your uranium past a certain amount, you can trade with all these countries. And it was a whole bunch of countries that were in this deal, and Trump pulled out. And though the Iranians did nothing wrong, all the inspectors said they'd done nothing wrong, and now the Iranians can't trade. And the Iranians specifically elected a president who, you know, we could argue about their government, but they elected a moderate president who said we should keep negotiating with the West because it will help our economy. And so they negotiated this deal. Now they can't trade. And now, like Olivia was saying, now there are all these hostilities, that provocations that the U.S. is cooking up, a sort of trickle of like, oh, there's a, you know, a Japanese ship that was hit by a mine that was Iranian, and this tanker was taken by this country, and there was this drone shot down. So this steady drip of hostilities arising, which is all a plan to get into some sort of battle with Iran. And this would be a catastrophic, terrible battle for all sorts of people all around the region, not just in Iran, all over the place. It would be terrible for so many sectors of this place. And the problem is there's almost no anti-war agitation even possible in our society right now because the narrative is just so messed up and the practices of the media and the think tanks and everything are so messed up. So we're really in an extremely dangerous situation. I was just at a wedding this weekend. One of the people at my reception table, a guy who I'd never met, flies for the Air Force. And he flies B-52s. B-52s carry 20 nuclear cruise missiles. He was deployed to Qatar with his B-52 over 2 months ago. This is, so it's not a joke. These are things we should be paying attention to in a reasonable society, but unfortunately, that's not what we live in right now, and we have to do as much as we can to change that.
Yeah, and you brought up, the news that's coming out of Iran right now, what their government is doing, and, you see it with Venezuela, too. And I think, especially with Venezuela, it is a chance for the United States to use socialism as a punching bag. And when the reality is that so much of the problems are coming from the United States itself. And the Iranian government right now is in a heightened state of reaction and heightened security and crackdown right now because of the tensions that the U.S. sanctions have caused. So it's another example of how these sanctions don't bring peace and how we need to stand against the sanctions and also stand in solidarity with activists in Iran and in Venezuela as they stand against U.S. imperialism. And it's not an occasion for us to detail our criticisms of their governments. It's right now, as U.S.-based organizations, we need to stand against our own government's violence against the people of these countries.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people out there who say that what they think, what they have to say doesn't matter, that it wouldn't change the outcome. What would you say to them?
Yeah, it's an incredibly convenient belief for many people to hold. And we have to take creative steps and any steps we can. I don't have a long, long track record of fighting these things and knowing about these things, but going to events, meeting people, asking questions, hearing from speakers, hearing slightly different takes, all of these things make little differences that people take, little actions people take in their lives start to add up. And so I definitely say to listeners out there, say it won't matter, okay? Look, if we all believe that, then we are going to get results that we have no control over. And what I'm saying to you right now is we need to very much be interested in taking power over these systems because the people operating them are not messing around and they are not going to wait for us. And the effects, the terrible effects on others and on ourselves are very real. So what I'm not saying to people is, oh, we're going to have this rally on Sunday and it's going to stop all of this. It is a very, very, it's going to be an arduous, long process, but, we can do it. There are electoral avenues forward that are positive. There are on the ground avenues forward that are positive. So come to our event on Sunday at 1:00. It's right at Salmon Springs Fountain, the amphitheater right there by the waterfront in Southeast Portland. There will be 5 really, really great speakers there. You can meet people. You can hear from some of the most smart, worldly, original creative thinkers and people in the whole city will be there talking because they care about this. And then there will be a march through the streets led by people who have been protesting wars for decades here in Portland. So those are some of the details. We'll go through more of the details later, but you're asking a great question. And yeah, there aren't that many people who rose up to oppose like the Venezuela threatened coup, but like there were some of us who did and we put together events and we're doing what we can. But like, this is what we got right now. Like there's not that much of a platform for this.
Yeah, and I really think these things start from the bottom up. The more we show out in force, the more the people in power can't ignore us. And, it's our responsibility to show up because it's our tax dollars that are directly going towards these wars. And, while people in our own country are dying because our society doesn't take care of them, it's also a class issue. It's poor people that the military recruits to go and die in these wars. It's poor people that are killed in these wars. And it's the rich that benefit from it. It is war profiteers, weapons manufacturers, investment bankers who invest in these companies. They profit from this endless violence. So, we're saying an end to war profiteering, an end to the military-industrial complex, and an end to imperialism. So no war but class war.
So this is a local event. How have you seen Oregon legislatures and local politicians respond to the rising tensions in Iran and also what the federal government is doing?
I'll just be brief. I mean, there's nowhere near the amount of dialogue locally in Portland or regionally or nationally. There's almost no reasonable, rational dialogue given the threats. So it's just an awful situation that people should feel insulted by the lack of discussion of it. I mean, we really have to, like, I think there are people like in our media and in our city government who like would listen to these arguments, but it's almost a situation where in our national political discourse, where if you say that you're against overthrowing, you know, the president of Venezuela, that you are seen as like a crazy person. And that's just insane. It's terrible, and we need to change it. And there are many of us who are trying to change that.
And I think that elected officials, especially at the local level, often say, well, this has nothing to do with us. And that's not true. Every single government body is complicit, right down to the contracts that our city has with companies that are potentially profiting off this type of violence. Mm-hmm. So we're urging our elected officials to use their platform to speak out and act on it in any way they can, while also overseeing that the operations the city does, you know, isn't complicit in these types of war crimes.
So let's talk about the city council resolution. Tell us more about what that is.
Well, there are five so far speakers that we have lined up for this event, and two of them are Iranian, at least Iranian descendant, Sahar Muranovich and Gudarz Ekhtadari. And Gudarz has started drafting a resolution, and we will be putting it out to the public soon. And it will, so we'll look for a co-sponsor from some member of city council, and it will just declare things like the city wants, as the UN Secretary General said, a surge of diplomacy between these countries. So in other words, talks versus punitive sanctions and threats of military action and stuff like that. So a surge of diplomacy, also calling, the city would call for a lifting of sanctions. Like we said, these sanctions mean lack of medicine, lack of food, excessive punishment on masses of population. So the resolution looks really good, and we'll be putting it out soon, and people can check it out through the Peace and Justice Works website, and it'll probably be placed on the Facebook event for the Facebook page for this event, which is being hosted by Jewish Voice for Peace and co-hosted by Democratic Socialists of America. While we're on that topic, there are, we talked about some of the political landscape, but the Multnomah County Democrats have co-sponsored this event. The Progressive Party of Oregon, the Pacific Greens have, DSA has co-sponsored, and then a lot of the justice-oriented groups in town, Jewish Voice for Peace, Hands Off Venezuela, Peace and Justice Works, some of the more lefty churches, let's say, and something like 35 groups.
All right. If you guys each had one final message for our listeners, what would it be?
Stop the U.S. war machine. We need all of you to show up in full force as much as you can. So please be out there on Sunday with us.
Yeah, now is the time to act. Like, this is our future. This is an enormous point right now, an enormously important point, that if we don't take control of the reins, it is reasonable to expect some escalating disasters like we haven't seen. And so it's time to show up. You can trust that there are people here in the city and regionally who care and who are going to keep going. So your actions will matter. There will be things, reasonable ways that you can be involved, and reasonable expectation that we can actually win this. So stay in it. Don't be discouraged. Don't tune out. Tune in. It's on Sunday at 1 p.m. And if you'd like to help out with security, we actually need people to train in security, and the training for that is tomorrow, Wednesday, at 6 to 8 p.m. at Augustana Lutheran Church. You can contact a longtime experienced security provider at events named Joe Keating. His number is 503-234-2613. That's 503-234-2613, or email at iraq@pjw.info. That's iraq@pjw.info. So come train to be in security for the event that'll start at 1 p.m. on Sunday, the 28th of July, at the amphitheater next to the Salmon Street Fountain downtown. Portland.
For KBOO News, I'm Mackenzie Beard.
And I'm Lisa Loving. The St. Francis Church congregation spent last night protesting at the Catholic Archdiocese of Portland Pastoral Center. Here to talk about what's going on is Melinda Pittman, Corey Cachola, and Tricia Zagrang. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We're going to just leap right into this incredibly fascinating issue. Now, which church are we talking about, and why is it an important institution in our community?
Well, right now we're talking about St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church, just four blocks up the street from us. And St. Francis has been around for over 135 years, and our dining hall has been around for over 40 years. And so we're talking specifically about what's happening at St. Francis with the authoritarianism and the conservatism of the current archdiocese. But we're also talking about what's happening in conservatism as the American bishops are trying to move the entire progressive Catholic community. And yes, there are many progressive Catholics.
I want to talk about that.
Trying to move that whole segment of the population out of the church so that they can be authoritative, what we call clerics, clericalism, and feudal. And it's manifesting itself on small levels here in St. Francis and on huge levels internationally.
Okay. Talk a little bit about the history of St. Francis, the local church. How did it become so progressive? We have other progressive churches, too, and I know there's some in the Seattle area.
Certainly.
How did that happen?
Well, I think St. Francis became progressive the way all Catholic churches and congregations become. It's the people. Many of the people at St. Francis were very involved in protesting the white train and very involved in protesting the Vietnam War. So I think it started out after Vatican II, which opened up the whole array to regular lay people. St. Francis really jumped down in front on these issues of social justice, of including immigrants, of including gay and lesbian people, of having the priests not be over the congregation but with us, and having conversations about things that were important to us. And we started the dining hall because we saw a need, and this was before my time, but there was a need for the growing houseless population, people who were low income and families and people who just didn't have food. So the dining hall is one of our biggest and strongest community missions. We do a lot of other stuff and join with other organizations to participate in Pride events, for example, and to go to a lot of protests. So that's the history of St. Francis. We're also a very creative community. One of our members is an artist, and many people at KBOO will know that the famous Martin Luther King silhouette that's at the all the MLK days, it's, you know, white on a blue field. That's one of our artists. She created it for St. Francis. And every year, that banner goes out to all the MLK celebrations. So we see ourselves very much in the progressive, forward-moving, inclusive world of social justice.
Okay. Now, talk about what has changed. What's going on now?
Oh, gosh. And I'm going to take this one, too, and then I'm going to shut up for a minute anyway. What has changed is horrifying. From the level of big deals like misogyny, which is throughout the whole institution, not only of Catholics, but a lot of evangelical, a lot of faith institutions have become very conservative. So what has changed about that is this particular archdiocese, this bishop, whose name is Archbishop Sample, has told all his minions that there will never be inclusive language used in our church again, ever. Well, this breaks a 60-year tradition. It's unbelievable to me. It also goes to other things. Women are no longer going to be allowed, are now not allowed to be anywhere near the altar during a service. So there are things that are internal to the way progressive Catholics celebrate our faith tradition. There's also other things like how we welcome the people at the dining hall. The dining hall hours have been cut because the current priest at St. Francis says that it is not in his job to support the dining hall. Not in his job description. They've told us that we can't have masses outside, which is when we celebrate climate and the earth and reverence for the earth. They've taken away all the music that has been composed for 60 years by people at St. Francis, so that it's not just, you know, the traditional songs. But like recently we have been singing the Sheryl Crow song, "Peace be upon us, peace be upon us, be upon us all. Ashalem aleikum wa aleikum ashalem." Told us that we can never sing that because, you know, of course, that's Muslim, and we couldn't possibly sing that in a Catholic church. So the oppression is growing. And as a result, many people have left, and many people are protesting. So it's not just St. Francis, though. This thumb of oppression on all kinds of people is being just ground into the page by the hierarchy. And the people are revolting.
Okay, a lot of us don't know much about how Catholic churches are run. Can you talk about the leadership structure and who's in charge here in Southeast Portland?
Yeah, Corey is going to talk about that.
Thanks, Corey.
Well, the leadership structure, I think actually, Melinda, you'd be better at describing.
Well, it's a hierarchy. Yeah. There's an institution, which is a corporation. And then the leadership structure is very what we call feudal and clerical, top-down, unquestioned. That's not the structure of the people, though, and the celebrants. It's certainly not the structure of the people that we include in our community. So the structure is what we're really protesting, is the... Well, it just echoes the national scene. You know, it's basically the few dictating to the many in ways that are very hurtful. Is that clear enough?
Yeah, because now, absolutely. Because that my next question is, what is happening at the national level? Like when you're talking about how this is it's national, it's an international issue, of course. But talk about that. What is the bigger picture? What are other people going through as well?
Well, and I think Melinda laid that out so nicely, because that's the lead in to, you know, what's happening at St. Francis. You know, I've thought it from the beginning of when things started changing at St. Francis, that there's a direct correlation between the church and politics. You know, national politics, global politics, really. Populism that's sweeping the world is oddly connected, you know. And I was always, since, you know, Trump took office, I've been studying, you know, authoritarianism. I'm a journalism graduate, and you know, I just had a real knack for like looking into these issues and getting on Twitter and you know, really learning a lot of these, you know, peeling off the onion layers, because there's so many of them. But at the church level, you begin to see like evangelicalism is in the news a lot about how it influences national politics. So that's I think that's out there in the media. But what's not known, and what is actually just coming out, you know, a kind of real time now, is that there's a massive Catholic, you know, right-wing conservative element of media. It's all driven by media.
Steve Bannon.
Right, the Steve Bannons.
Is one of those Catholic conservatives that is driving that media.
Right, Bannon is actually in Italy, as I understand it, right now. And one of his objectives is they set up shop across the Vatican, and he is a consultant to what they call, like, you know, anti-Francis, anti-Pope Francis elements that are kind of inside the Vatican. And they are working exactly like they did with politics here to subvert all that and kind of turn it into a exactly like they did with politics here, a Trumpism and this, you know, European populist. They're connecting all those things together, and they, you know, their plan is to, you know, they can't stand Pope Francis. So there's people waiting in the wings, and
yeah,
it's scary.
Pope Francis is a socialist.
Right. And a lot of people, I think, that are not Catholics, they think, well, who cares? It's, you know, the Catholic Church, the sexual abuse. You know, I know a lot of people, especially in Portland, will say, like, you know, just let the whole thing fall. It doesn't matter. These Catholics are, you know, doing terrible things anyway. But the problem with that is that, you know, this is just like with the evangelicals, you see they're embedded so deeply that you can't just leave it as a void. And that's why we're doing the activist things that we're doing.
That brings us to Catholic Women's Strike, which is the organization, really the umbrella organization that's sponsoring the Speak Out Against the Archdiocese. Now, can someone tell me about what is Catholic Women's Strike? What do you do?
Yes, Catholic Women's Strike is a result of what happened in May of this year, which is the committee to study the ordination of women deacons in the Catholic Church was disbanded without any recommendations and without a public report. And what Pope Francis had to say, they agreed that there were tens of thousands of women deacons and that they were ordained in the exact same way as men. So they've raised the bar to, but we don't know whether they meant them to be equal or not. So as a result, hundreds of parishes in Germany and Austria had strikes from May 11th to May 18th. So I started Catholic Women's Strike in response to see if we can get some strikes going over here in the United States, because I'd like to see strikes everywhere, because I feel like the only way we will get ordained women is if the laity rises up and pushes back.
All right. Now, what are your asks for our listeners right now? We talked about this a little in advance. What are you asking everyday people to do?
Well, we do want to let women know, even if they're not Catholic, that they can join us. They can get on Catholic Women's Strike and follow what we're doing. And
on Facebook and
on Facebook,
Twitter.
We are doing protests once a month. We're doing various things in the church, so if they're not in the church, that wouldn't fit. But they can get on and see what we're doing and join us.
And we'll have a website soon with a lot of this information, too.
We also are doing small and big. So if you really want to do something locally, you can call the archbishop and complain about him institutionalizing misogyny and deliberately excluding women and hiring priests that call women demons. And the Archbishop's number is, Tricia?
The phone number for Archbishop Samples is 503-234-5334. If you didn't have a pencil, just Google Archdiocese Portland and you'll get the phone number.
So I think personal appeals to the Archbishop are very strong. Tell them that we won't stand for women being subjugated anymore. Then on a greater level, Corey is a master researcher. And at some time very soon, we're going to have a forum where Corey and others who have been researching these connections between all the conservative movements, both in the United States and globally. And so if you are interested in learning more about why this is important, even if you're not Catholic. You know, it's like any faith tradition. If we were Muslim or Quaker or Buddhists, we would be, if those congregations and faith traditions were being attacked, we would want to stand with them. Mm-hmm. So we're asking the public, you don't have to be Catholic to be against this kind of feudalism.
To be outraged. Now, yeah. We're running out of show.
Sorry.
Okay. How do people connect with you?
To connect on...
People who want to be active. I know. So you've got the
right.
Facebook page for Catholic Women's Strike. Is there any other way?
So right now, we started on Facebook, Tricia and I, and we're on Facebook, Twitter. But we will have this... We're about to have a website, and we're going to have a lot of resources on there that are going to help people do activism and these kind of things and join us.
Also on Facebook, there's a Saint St. Francis People. So it's STFRANCISPEOPLE, and we post our upcoming events on that.
I want to thank Melinda Pittman, Corey Cachola, and Tricia Zagrang for coming in from the St. Francis of Assisi Church and Catholic Women's Strike, and thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Jana Jihad Tamimi, 13-year-old Palestinian activist, began recording, reporting on, and sharing her lived reality from the age of 7, shortly after two of her relatives were killed by Israeli forces. Jana now enjoys a global following, serves as ambassador of the South African Palestinian Children's Initiative, and has been awarded internationally for her media role. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.